And welcome again to another edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, the director of Jewish Sacred Aging. And we welcome you to what we hope will be, or we know will be, a very informative conversation. And it is with a great deal of pleasure that we welcome to today's edition in a special recognition of February and Heart Month, Dr. Robert Singer. Welcome him back to Secrets of Meaning. Dr. Singer is the chair of the Department of Medicine at the Virtua Health Systems, Virtua Hospital in Southern New Jersey. Dr. Singer, welcome. It's good to see you again.
Good day. Thanks for having me.
First of all, how are you? How's the family in the midst of all this craziness? How are things, I imagine, very, very stressful at the hospital?
Everything, the family's doing well, thank you. I think that everyone is under multiple types of stress between the hospital. I know it's where I just came from this morning. There's a high level of stress, and amongst family members, it goes day by day. But overall, everyone is doing well, thank you, and surviving.
You know, because, and again, thank you for joining us. It is Heart Month, and I really wanted to have a conversation with you about some of the issues. But let's just jump right into this. We're about to enter year three of this COVID pandemic. You're on the front lines of this at the hospital and in private practice in Southern New Jersey. What have you seen as the major impact on heart health as a result of the pandemic?
Well, many people have stopped doing and stopped living. And unfortunately, they used to get out and walk. They used to exercise. They used to interact with their peers, their friends, their family. And all of that has gone by the wayside for many people. There are so many people that have given up on their gym memberships, have stopped exercising. Their diet is not quite as good because they can't get they can't get out to really do the shopping, or they're afraid to do shopping. So you have many more people that are shut-ins and are just not watching their cardiovascular risk factors. And on top of that, there's the great deal of stress. We turn on the TV and we see a lot of bad things going on. And stress does have an impact, although it's very hard to measure exactly what it does. But it does have an impact on our overall health and cardiovascular health. When we are under a great deal of emotional stress on a day in, day out basis, we can't visit the grandchildren, the family doesn't come over, we don't have that social interaction, the hand on the shoulder, it's missing. And it does have an impact on overall health.
The stress factor tied in with, I would imagine this, and you alluded to this, the increase in isolation, yes, which has led to a lot of mental health concerns. We were talking before we went on, and almost every meeting or class that I'm doing or conference that I'm attending, this mental health issue just bubbles up right to the surface. How does this mental health explosion and mental health concern impact the cardiovascular system?
Well, it could increase our blood pressure. You know, you also notice that people aren't taking their medicines quite as they used to and as the way they should. But the overall stress can increase blood pressure and cause overall increased inflammation in the body, which can lead to cardiovascular events. And when we're talking about blood pressure, there's more and more research being done out there that says that if you don't have well-controlled blood pressure, it could lead to aging of the brain quicker. An increased incidence of dementia, which is, you know, on everyone's minds right now. No one, as they get older, wants to have dementia as a problem. And what they're finding is that heart health equals brain health. So all the stresses that people are under, you know, can increase your blood pressure. You're not exercising as much. You're not doing things for that your body needs. And although it's hard to quantify right now, we see it in our individual practices. Is an overall decrease in cardiovascular health.
I was reading an article recently that really was pushing the exercise thing, the even moderate exercise, and they were still quoting, I think, a government figure of 150 minutes a week that the government was. So
right.
this idea, how, and you alluded to this inflammation issue, which comes up a lot in these conversations and articles in the popular press. Could you just walk us through the relationship of exercise reducing inflammation in the body and how that affects the heart and then the brain?
I'm not sure I can walk you through exactly, but overall, the more we exercise, it improves our many chemicals in the body. And I don't think all the research has been done on that, which will lower blood pressure. And the higher the blood pressure we have, the more stress on blood vessels, which could lead to, in the brain, where you have very tiny blood vessels, damage to those leading to dementia. And as far as inflammation goes, that also has to do with our diet. And inflammation in and of itself can cause damage to blood vessels. So there's not an actual cascade, an exact cascade. But we know that inflammation does do bad things to blood vessels, and it's brought down by a good diet, a good balanced diet, exercise, and less stress. All right. Now, how do I tell someone to have less stress? That's difficult. But exercise and eating well is a good start.
What about, have you ever talked to your patients? Because I've talked to a bunch of friends of mine who, and I am a news junkie, so I'll read 2-3 newspapers a day, and I used to sit on MSNBC and CNN all the time in my spare time. But I've cut way back, and I've talked to a lot of friends of mine who've done the same thing. Have you talked to patients of saying, you know, maybe you should not read so much and watch so much news because it's really, especially at bedtime, you know, is that possible?
I've actually told them, turn it off and do something more pleasant. I'll tell some patients that if they watch one news channel, maybe they should watch the opposite news channel every now and then to see what everyone else is talking about and thinking about. But overall, I tell people not to watch anymore. And as an aside, I think that the Hallmark channel, the ratings have gone way up because those are pleasant, happy things to watch on TV every day.
Yes. I mean, within the first 15 minutes of every Hallmark movie, you know who's going to wind up with who, and you just roll through it, you know?
But it's no stress involved.
No. I mean, and with no baseball right now, I mean, hopefully the time this airs, somebody will do something. That's only adding to the stress, I guess. You know what? Speaking of inflammation, I was told many years ago and that as I get older, as part of my morning routine, I take a baby aspirin, because that baby aspirin is going to be the frontline guard against cardiovascular disease and that heart attack. And now I'm hearing and reading, and you alluded to this before the show, well, maybe that's not so true, depending on how old you are. Could you just walk us through that one?
So the American Preventive Society basically said that for patients over 60 years old, if you've never had a heart attack before, or you don't have cardiovascular disease or a stroke, you shouldn't be on aspirin preventatively, because the incidence of bleeding, gastrointestinal otherwise, is somewhat equivalent to the risk prevention from an aspirin. So they say basically aspirin is off the table. Now, somebody may ask, well, what about the reduction in colon carcinoma from aspirin that was reported a few years ago? And now what we're reading is that association is not well defined, that there is not necessarily reduction in colon cancer risk from aspirin. So overall, the decrease in heart attack and stroke is about equal to increase in bleeding, and therefore it's not worthwhile doing. Now, for those under 60, from 40 to 60 years old, if you have what they call a 10-year risk of a cardiovascular event, then aspirin is acceptable in prevention. And so when we see people, we put it all together. You know, they may not have a known heart attack or a stroke, but if you have high blood pressure and diabetes and multiple members of your family have had heart attacks or strokes, perhaps it's worthwhile. Now, there are some new tests out there, or actually not so new, but they're being used more, something called the coronary calcium score. And this is a low-level radiation CAT scan, which picks up calcium in the coronary arteries. So if we see a significant amount of calcium, we say, yes, you have cardiovascular disease and you should go on aspirin. So this is all an evolving way of doing things. And it's interesting, this coronary calcium score has not been paid for by insurances. It's not ultra expensive. It's up to about $200 a study, but nonetheless, insurance doesn't cover it, but it gives us a lot of information. And I think that will be the way of the future, where over a certain age, you will get a coronary calcium score. And on the basis of that, you'll be added aspirin and or a statin type drug like Lipitor or Crestor. So for right now, for over 60, if you've never had an event, speak to your doctor, and chances are that you should not be on aspirin for prevention.
How I mean, the research into coronary disease, can you just give us an idea of what really is emerging, the frontier? Is there huge progress being made in the reduction of coronary disease in the United States, given the diet that most Americans have?
I think we've made great strides, but also obesity has come into play. So as we've made great strides, obesity is coming more into play, and we have an aging population. So there's still a very large degree of cardiovascular disease in the world. There are new drugs being used to help prevent diabetes, which is a big disease which does cause coronary artery disease. But as far as the cure for coronary disease, we do not have it. As far as cholesterol lowering goes, we've done a great job with statins, and now there are new drugs that are just given once or twice a month to reduce cholesterol. They do a terrific job, but we do not have the answer. So not everyone with high cholesterol has a heart attack or a stroke, and not everyone with perfectly normal cholesterol doesn't have a heart attack or a stroke. So we still, 100 years from now, they will be laughing at us because we didn't pick up the markers. And so there are people looking at markers, LP little A and other subtypes in the lipids to find that ideal marker. But what we need to do overall as we get older is to keep exercising. Exercise lowers LDL, your bad cholesterol. It raises HDL, your good cholesterol. But right now, new things to help prevent coronary disease, not that I've been reading, I'm sure it's out there in the scientific literature.
You know, it's amazing when we talk, one of the workshops we do in Jewish Sacred Aging is this whole tracing of health and wellness, physical and mental health through Jewish tradition. And it's always fascinating to teach, just on what you were saying. There's this passage in Maimonides, which is 12th century, about getting up, moving, got to get your body moving, can't sit still, and he ties it into a lot of other things. But here's something from our tradition, from the Jewish tradition, that is exactly what you were saying. I mean, it's fascinating.
We have to get out of the house. We need to walk. It's good for mental health. It's good to see other people. We got to keep our bodies moving.
You know, I know there's a lot of people when the gyms died and we stopped going to gyms, went out and bought bike. That's exactly what I did. It's been a lifesaver. The Pelotons, just to do something.
Right.
Which leads me to something, the role of genetics. How important is that genetic?
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You know, we've seen it in not only coronary disease, but we're starting to see it with some arrhythmias like atrial fibrillation, which maybe many boomers and elderly are prone to, that there are genetic components here. Certainly there are genetic components for high blood pressure. We see it run in family lines, genetic components of hyperlipidemia, heart attack and stroke. Unfortunately, we also see it in things like dementia.
Yes, I know.
But genetics plays a huge role here. So I think that if you have a strong family history, you need to know about it, of coronary disease, you need to know about it and do everything you can to watch every one of your risk factors.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Singh.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. We'll get to food in a minute. I just wanted to remind people that you're Dr. Robert Singer, the chair of the Department of Medicine at Virtua Health and Hospital here in Southern New Jersey. And again, this is Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. If you'd like to contact us, by the way, you can email me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com if you have a suggestion, an idea for future programs, etc. So let's go back to that diet thing that you started on about the heart healthy diet, and every sort of like once every couple of weeks, there's another article about the Mediterranean diet. Eat the Mediterranean diet and you will live forever. You can drink coffee, but no, don't drink coffee. It was just something in the paper today. It says, well, only drink black coffee. Don't do anything else. What's the story here? Is this hype or is moderation really the key?
I think that you could go to 10 cardiologists and get 10 different answers. What I tell my patients is that eating is a joyful part of life. You know, it's something, you know, you may be having horrible arthritis or something else is going on, but you can eat and you can gain some pleasure from it. But as you said, everything in moderation and a balanced diet. We know that we shouldn't be eating meat every day, maybe once a week, maybe twice a week. Coffee, I find that's fine. Some people think that coffee doesn't even lead to arrhythmias. So everything is okay as long as it's done in moderation. But barring any other issues, eat away, enjoy your diet as long as it's a balanced diet. Get some fish into your diet. Get a lot of green vegetables into your diet. Just don't abuse food. And we tend to do it. I mean, one of the problems at nighttime is that we all tend to eat, which leads to weight gain. It's comfort food. It's something to do at nighttime while we're watching TV. And that's probably something that leads to much weight gain in our country.
There's some anecdotal conversation about the fact that baby boomers really are much more attuned to their health, and in truth may actually be healthier than our own children. Have you seen this?
It's hard to see in one practice whether or not that's true or not. I think boomers are much more interested in their health, but I find that many of the young generation, a gym is part of their life and exercise is part of their life. And, you know, a lot of it also depends on socioeconomic status, you know, how people are caring for themselves. If you don't have enough, you know, money to go on, you're not going to be necessarily eating well. There are parts of the country that are just in food deserts. And so it's hard to eat well for some members of our communities and in the country. But I haven't seen necessarily boomers are healthier than the younger, but they certainly are more attuned to it and they think about it more.
Dr. Singh, you alluded to something that I really want to ask you about on the basis of your own practice, and that is this, I don't know how the right word is, challenge, let's use the word challenge in the United States of America right now for equality and access to healthcare. Because you alluded to this, the socioeconomic challenges. I'm sure you see some of this in your practice in cardiology and also as chair of medicine at Virtua. How pronounced is this? How damaging is this to people who, if you're living in certain zip codes in this country, you can pretty much get well taken care of. You live in a zip code that's down the street or the next zip code, your options are very, very, very limited. How much do you see of this?
A fair amount. I really do. And, you know, I see that people have access to healthcare, some easier than others. But when you go home, you know, if the doctor tells you you need to exercise, but you're taking care of parents, you're taking care of children, you're taking care of a disabled brother or sister, you don't have time to exercise and you don't have any support systems. It all depends on your support systems. I did have an episode a few years ago where a patient came in to me and was just cursing the president about how terrible Obamacare was, the Affordable Care. This is the worst thing. It's costing me more money. And, you know, I shook my head and, okay. And then literally the next patient came in who just got insurance and said, thank God for Obamacare. I have insurance now. I could take care of my problems. So yes, we're in. It's a very difficult problem in this country. I think the access, people can access it, but what they do with that health care, we definitely have inequalities in this country. You know, how can you access the best medicine for you? You know, when we're dealing with coronary disease and congestive heart failure, we're talking about 4, 5, 6 pills. That's huge amounts of money. And if you're socioeconomically distressed, you're not going to be able to afford these medicines. Atrial fibrillation is a great example. We use these novel oral anticoagulant drugs. Eliquis and Xarelto are brand names. They're very expensive medications. And if you don't have the right insurance, you're plumb out of luck and you get a secondary medicine, which is much more difficult to take, warfarin or Coumadin. So there are definite inequalities. Whether or not they could be completely smoothed out or that they're smoothed out in anywhere else in the world, I don't know. We could always do a better job then.
It must be very frustrating when you see this, because with a desire to really help your patients and then facing the economic and social realities that they may not be able to do exactly what you're talking about or what you're prescribing for them.
It becomes impossible. Like you want them to take a certain drug and they say, I can't afford it. And I say, well, the other drug is not going to be as good for you. It's going to be more difficult and you won't be as healthy on it. And you come to odds, because what do you do with that? And then, you know, sometimes to get the more expensive drugs, the medical system has to jump through hoops. You know, it could be 10, 15, 20 phone calls to get that medicine for the patient for a reasonable price.
You see any way out of this? I mean, just you're in the trenches every day. Do you see any way out of this, given the political mess that we're in?
Yeah, if I could enter the Medicare for All, I don't know whether or not Medicare for All is Medicare the way we have it now. That's the problem. I think it would change over time. So I don't have a good answer for you. I don't have a good, especially in the situation we're in right now with, you know, with money as far as in the government. It would cost a lot of money to spread things out and deep things out. I'm not sure that we have the political capital or even that the medical world is on the same page. I think we're as equally divided as any other section of the society.
It's interesting. Thank you for that. I want to also ask you about this explosion in tech.
Yeah.
So here's my Apple Watch, and you've told me that when I press the little heart icon and check my heart rate or do the EKG on the Apple Watch, that it may not be hospital, but it's not too bad. And then I see advertisements for other tech issues and order this from Amazon, and you can send a professional grade EKG to your doctor or whatever, and there's rings and other. What's the story? How valuable as a tool? How accurate are these things? Where do you stand on this explosion of heart technology and health technology?
It's coming down. I think we're at the beginning, but remote patient monitoring is huge. We could help prevent hospitalizations. We could keep people healthier if we could watch their blood pressures more closely. Arrhythmia monitoring is big as in the cardiovascular world, as you alluded to, the devices where you can see your heart rhythm. And a computer can read it, and you could send on the rhythm strips to your physician. We also have tools to watch patients for congestive heart failure at home to monitor them. Of course, it takes a bank of nurses or well-trained professionals to watch all these devices on the outside to watch the patients. But the technology of monitoring at home is huge. I think there are other things coming to play, like virtual office visits. Which I think that you're going to read a lot about, and it's going to also explode in. With COVID, this really took off. Now, unfortunately, I'm not a big believer in virtual visits because I can't listen to the heart well. I can't examine your legs to see if they're filled with fluid. I can't I can't listen to your lungs. I don't think it's great for a cardiologist. For other specialties, perhaps, but I think that's going to grow. And I think that also artificial intelligence is a big thing. Perhaps we don't need physicians overreading certain radiologic studies, certain x-rays, CAT scans. Maybe it's all artificial intelligence. And it may come to the point where you go to literally Dr. Google with your symptoms and you put it in and you get your diagnosis and you go to the pharmacy and you pick up your own medicines. It may get to be that good. I'm not sure in our lifetime, but that's where we're heading. Right. That is definitely where we're heading. It's really cool stuff. And I think that it'll be used more and more to keep people out of the hospital. I know in our hospital, we're thinking about doing hospital at home, where instead of admitting patients, we use technology in the patient's own home with frequent nurse visits in the course of a day. Let's say two nurse visits in the course of the day. I'm just throwing that out there to keep people at home instead of them having to come into the hospital, especially during COVID times, and have more exposures.
Speaking of you know, the virtual stuff and the internet stuff, we had a brief conversation about this a while ago. What's your feeling professionally and about people sitting at home and saying, "Okay, I have this feeling. I immediately go to WebMD or one of the other things, and I read out all the things, and I realize, oh my, I must have A, I must have B, I must have C." Do you caution patients to say, you know, just time out, don't jump to any conclusions?
It's a problem on a daily basis. That's not a problem. It's an issue on a daily basis. Everyone should read about their symptoms. And maybe Google has saved so many lives because people will say, hey, that may be heart disease, and they come in. But we also get a fair number of people who don't have heart disease coming in and accessing the system. So I think as a society, for better or for worse, we're accessing care more frequently because we can look up our symptoms and we say maybe it's A or B. And so for some atypical chest discomfort, we get to see our primary care physician, the cardiologist, the gastroenterologist, and get an endoscopy and a stress test, only to find out, hey, if I just took a little bit of Zantac over the counter, I would be okay. So, but you know, it does increase the cost of care and people's stress also. So it has two edges, the good side and the bad side.
Final thing I wrote it down and I just want to get some reaction from you, because again, there's been things in the press that numbers, you know, there's an ideal blood pressure number, there's an ideal this number. Do those numbers change as we get older? Is there a greater fluidity or you know, bandwidth?
So we find again that heart health really equates to good brain health. It improves brain health. And the lower we can get the blood pressure in the elderly or in the boomer population, the better brain health will be. So we really want to shoot for a low blood pressure, a 110 or a 120. The problem is in those age groups, when you lower the blood pressure in the office to 110, 120, many times they go home and they get dizzy from low blood pressure. So there's no good answer. And I'm usually shooting for a blood pressure of 130, 135, because I know in the office, patients are, they're concerned, they're agitated, they're in my office, they're not relaxed as they are at home. So the lower we can get the blood pressure, the better. It's just as important in the boomer population as it is in a younger population. And it does equate to better overall cardiovascular health, keeping the blood pressure low. But again, we can't cause patients to be passing out at home. And that's the difficulty.
Dr. Robert Singer, Chair of... Go ahead.
Just one other quick thing. As we get older, you know, we get into our 80s, let's say, patients are on 5, 6, 7 meds. And one of the things that has come up recently is that should we be withdrawing medicines? If we have an 85-year-old, a 90-year-old on a statin at a high dosage, should we be reducing it? And there's no right answer, but there is literature saying that maybe we should reconsider all these pills that we have our octogenarians on, our nonagenarians on. And I think that's going to be coming up in the future. What do we do with all these medicines? And I think for right now, it's a one-on-one talk to your physician.
And on that, how important is the pharmacist who to monitor all these? Because I know a lot of people, I had this with my mom. she would go to so many different doctors with so many different prescriptions. Yep. How important is the pharmacy who would say, you know, whoa, time out. This pill A does not get along with pill D, and you should go talk to your doctor about this.
Well, it's interesting. I think the pharmacists get burnt out, as do the physicians. When I prescribe a medicine, it's usually on an electronic medical record, and I'll see all of the possible drug interactions. Oh. And you look at them, and they're the same drug interactions, and you just override it every time, and then you get burnt out by just all the warnings that come up. So yes, pharmacy is important, but all of these drugs interact in one way or another. There's some small interaction. And I think that as we get older, those interactions are more profound. So it's a difficult question. The pharmacist does play a role. But you know, the cardiologist wants you on two different or three different pills. Your diabetic doctor wants you on two or three different pills. Your rheumatologist wants you on another pill. Gastroenterologist on another pill. And they're all interacting. And as we get older, you know, we don't know exactly what it does in an individual person, and you need somebody to put it all together. You know, usually your primary care physician.
Right. And that's the need for being your own advocate and having somebody to really understand. That's and that's correct. And many of us have lived that with relatives and people we've cared for. So Dr. Robert Singer, the chair of the Department of Medicine at Virtua Healthcare, Virtua Hospital in Southern New Jersey. Thank you very, very much. Once again, stay safe, stay healthy. Good luck in the hospital. Say hello to the family for me, will you?
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Good health to everyone.
Anytime. And hopefully I'll see you at the ballpark sometime this year.
Wonderful. Sounds great.
To all of you, thank you again for being part of another Secrets of Meaning TV show and podcast from Jewish Sacred Aging. Again, we appreciate your support. If you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help support the work of these podcasts, you can go to the website, Jewish Sacred Aging, scroll down to the conveniently located donate button, click it, and follow the prompts. We appreciate, again, your time and your support. A big shout out to Steve Lubetkin, our producer, because these podcasts are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Until the next time, stay safe, stay healthy, everybody. Shalom, the hitter out.